I'm Susan, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 21st, 2000, and my home group is the Midtown Group, which meets Sunday nights up in Bethesda, Maryland. And I'm really glad to be here. I've met Billy a few times, and I've been down here to some of these meetings when my former sponsor has actually spoken down here and also with other friends. So it's nice to be back here again. And we just ate at the Pig and Steak, which was very, very, very nice. Very fun. So it's been a very nice afternoon come down here. But I just want to tell you, you know, in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. And I just want to say, you know, kind of from the outset, if anyone is new here, Alcoholics Anonymous definitely saved my life. And, you know, from the beginning, I was just hardwired to self-destruct. And now, because of the steps, you know, I've been healthy and I've been sober. And you know, my neighbors wouldn't guess how mentally defective I really am. You know, they just think I'm like a normal neighbor living next to them, taking the trash out, and they have no idea. You know what I mean? And that is 100% because of the 12 steps. Because I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I might look young to some of you guys, but I know it for sure, and I know it's my experience. Like the Big Book says that oftentimes women go beyond recall rather quickly, and that was my experience. And I'm really grateful for my understanding of the Big Book today, because you know, I understand today that my problem is like completely on the spiritual plane, and that's where the solution lies. And that took me a lot of beatings to kind of get around the right people who really did do Alcoholics Anonymous according to this book to understand. At first, I really thought all that alcoholism meant was I should have to stop drinking and things should pull together. And as I discovered, that was like just the tip of the iceberg. And the only thing that happens with me when I stop drinking is life becomes so unbearable, I either have to drink again or kill myself or change, you know, and the change, the only change that's ever worked for me has been the 12 steps. And, but again, that's like in hindsight, and it took me a long while to be able to finally come to understand what my problem was. As far back as I can remember, like, meaning even in kindergarten, I have very, very clear memories of being incredibly uncomfortable in my skin. Even in kindergarten, I had, like, naturally, like, without effort, it just seems to be, like, in this spiritual illness of mine, I guess, you know, some of my symptoms have always been, like, envy and, like, insatiable attention-seeking. And like almost like naturally always feeling like I was never enough. I was, and either like vacillating between feeling like way better than or way less than, and just generally feeling 100% ill at ease in my skin. And, like I said, I mean, there's this girl named Mary with blonde hair and blue eyes and Jordache clothes in kindergarten. And in kindergarten, I was like, oh, Mary, God, I'll never be like that. You know, and I just saw her around. And I had everything I could want in kindergarten. You know, I just came out of the womb like that. I really, like, looking backwards, I had that kind of broken lenses from as far back as I can remember. And what those, like, spiritual illness symptoms look like as I grew up, I mean, they just continued and they just got a lot worse. Like, all those years growing up, I just always felt just like this desperation on the inside for no factual reason. You know, if you looked at all of the categories of my life, they were just fine. You know, I had nothing to pinpoint why I should feel such desperation. But I felt weird, and people told me I was weird, you know, I started having, like, breakdowns in school because of the stress. Okay, that was, like, in seventh grade, I started having these, like, crying fits. I was like an A student in like a great school with loving parents, having like hysterical breakdowns. You know, I mean, that was like coming from my mind. There was nothing like based in fact that should have me feeling that way. And I actually started getting my mom to take me to doctors as early as fourth grade. I mean, I say this, it's kind of odd and funny, but it just kind of illustrates, like, my naturally ill mind. In fourth grade, I was sure I was developing breast cancer. And I was so convincing in my hysteria that I actually got my mom to take me to the doctor. And the doctor was, like, I mean, she pulled me out of school and everything, and the doctor was like, your daughter's developing breasts. You know, I thought I had two tumors. And he sent me home. He's like, she's developing breasts. She's fine. It's not breast cancer. And I just think about it today. I'm like, you know, what? You know? I kept demanding those doctor visits, actually, because I kept continuing to feel so ill at ease. And I wasn't sleeping, and I had, like, major anxiety and lots of diagnoses from well-meaning doctors, like, avalanched into my life as early as middle school. You know, I was, like, certainly emotionally off kilter. Like, that was clear. And the doctors had lots of different labels for all of these symptoms, you know, and over the years, starting in seventh grade, some of the labels that many well-meaning doctors wanted to put on my illness, you know, what was wrong with me was things like anxiety disorder, you know, sleeping disorder, depression, manic depression, borderline personality disorder, many, many different labels. And I would keep seeking, you know, like I was sure that I was different from my fellows. You know, mentally, I knew that. I knew I felt mentally different from my fellows from a very young age, and really did try to seek through doctors, you know, what's wrong with me? I feel on the inside something's wrong. But all of these times when they would give me these labels, nothing ever fit the bill. It just felt like it just didn't do it. Like, nothing ever, like, made everything make sense. Like, oh, that's what it is. Yeah. It was just like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, I have an anxiety disorder. Well, yeah, I mean, I could have told you that. I'm really anxious. I get it. But, you know, it's like, it was never helpful. You know what I mean? It was like, okay, well, now so what? You know, it's like, one of the avenues that I've tried in my sobriety, before my sobriety, was lots of medicines. That's kind of like a traditional medium of doctors, is like medicines, you know, pills and medicines. And I've been on most every medicine you can imagine to manage emotions, to manage depression, to manage manic depression, to manage psychoticness even. And I was like never outwardly psychotic. I was actually like quite the opposite. I would like stuff and stew and like think of killing myself. But I was like on even medications to like rein in like outwardly psychotic behavior, and I just took them without saying anything because I was desperate. And then I was on medicines even to manage the symptoms, because I was on so many different medicines, they were giving me new ones, like twitches and seizures. I mean, it was just, you know, and all those years I just kept seeking. And you know, I did go to the church. I was Catholic by kind of my parents, you know, so I would like shuffle in and out of there. I checked out books. I did every kind of seeking that I knew. And looking back again, like what I knew existed was very limited. And that is another fact to me, that God has been carrying me this whole time, because he did end me up in the solution. And that's amazing to me, considering how I was brought up and how helpless my parents had felt throughout this whole time. I mean, they just didn't know what was wrong with me. The only thing they had was, you know, the vehicle of money, which is wonderful. I mean, they really did what they could through that vehicle. And they also had the Catholic Church, you know, and I had books and I had friends, and I really tried to find out, a whole, you know, in every way I could, what was wrong with me. And when I was 18, I took my first drink. And I had actually judged the people in high school for drinking. I thought, look at them. They need to drink to have a crutch. Look at those people. I looked down on my friends for having to drink. Because I would go to the parties, and I thought, I don't need to drink, you know. And then one night, I don't know why, you know, I just thought, well, I'm just going to try a drink. And, oh, my God, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's like nothing you guys haven't heard, but I had no idea what was in store for me. I mean, I had no idea that that was possible. The Big Book talks a lot about, you know, what a spiritual awakening is and a spiritual experience and how through the steps I've now come to do and feel and believe like I couldn't have before on my unaided will alone. That's come to me now today in a genuine, healthy way through the steps, you know, with me and God in these steps. But I'll tell you what, alcohol straight up was a spiritual experience for me. And from the first time I took a drink, I did not stop to do anything else but drink. I mean, it enabled me to live my life in a second. I mean, it was utterly a 100% freedom. It changed everything. And I joke. I mean, I joke about it a lot, but it really was like a magical potion. It was nothing less than that to me. You know, it seemed to change everything around me. And most importantly, it 100% changed the way I felt in my own skin. It took away all of that negativity, all the anxiety, all the fear, all of the better than, less than, all that crazy pendulum feeling, everything. It took it all away. It made it vanish. And I drank for 5 years, and I think about that, and, this is why I cannot rest on my laurels in sobriety, you know. Because it really worked. I mean, like a hammer and a nail works. Like alcohol worked for me. I know today still that when I drink, the absolutely natural and innate uncomfortability I experience, like on a day-to-day level, that is like my spiritual illness, it vanishes from alcohol. Alcohol takes it away. And, I think back to my experiences while drinking and, I drank in very, very dirty places with dangerous people, and I drank in very, very exclusive places, you know, with celebrities and politicians. And the thing that is so remarkable to me is that in any one of those situations, it was magic. I felt 100% on an absolutely even playing field with me and whoever was with me. Whoever I was drinking with, you quite literally could have been at either end of the spectrum. And I felt at home in my skin. I felt whole. I felt complete. And I felt like you and I were just where we were supposed to be and, like, completely pH balanced, if that made sense. You know, like you know. And the Big Book again mentions, like, that I am, as an alcoholic, naturally restless, irritable, and discontent, you know? And I found peace and comfort and ease in alcohol, and that is why I've got to bust my butt every day, all over again, in AA. Because I do believe that alcohol would still work like that. It still would. It is still magical. I know it, you know? And the problem with alcohol was that over a period of time, it wore me down. And I just became, you know, physically and mentally very sick. And, you know, some of the things that also mean a lot to me in this book here is exactly what it means to be an alcoholic. Because that got me confused in early sobriety. And honestly, I feel like I'm amazed I'm here and I'm sober and I have the understanding I do. Because what I thought to be an alcoholic, what I used to think that meant, I mean, I'd be dead today. It's just not accurate, you know? It talks about the phenomenon of craving in the Big Book, and it says it's limited to, you know, our class of alcoholic. And I definitely experienced that phenomenon of craving. And once I started drinking, I absolutely could not stop. And there were times when I did try to stop. And I couldn't do that entirely. And that, to me, is the nutshell of what it means to be an alcoholic. And the Big Book tells me that. And I'm, like, so grateful that I 100% match up to that. So I'm like, that is me. And even in early sobriety, being very fried, I did crawl into this book, and I was like, oh, my God. It just was like, Susan. You know, I mean, I just related to so much of it. And it was a comfort that I'd never found before in all those years of seeking to find what my problem was, you know. This book was like, what is this weird, random book? I mean, I remember in some of my seeking before I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I was looking up a retreat center, or maybe it was a rehab or something, but I was, like, online looking for stuff, and it had the schedule. It said Big Book, and I thought that was the Bible, and I was like, oh, God. I was like, that's not going to do it. I already know that. I know the Bible. You know, and I had issues with it, and I had some bad experiences and some cranky beliefs, and I thought that the Big Book was the Bible here for a long time before I actually got here. And but again, with that drinking, when I put alcohol in my body, I had an absolute obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And allergy is like, I believe, that craving. Like, you put alcohol in me and it awakens this absolutely insatiable animal and I cannot get enough. And I'm just telling you, like, the way I drink, like, I would start drinking. I'd be drinking with one hand, I'd be lining up two and three, and probably I already drank a lot of hard liquor before you'd even see me that night, and I had some more in my purse. And just from the third time I ever drank, I blacked out, and I didn't know what a blackout was. You know, I just knew that I woke up the next morning, and I was in my leotard and tights from ballet. And I, like, woke up, and it was the sickest, horriblest feeling. I was like, I knew I had not gone out that night in my leotard, you know, in tights. And I just had that horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach that I'd have, like, for the next 5 years straight of, oh, my God, what happened? How is this? Something, I'm missing something. That morning in bed, I came to realize what a blackout was. I had no idea what it even was. I just knew all of a sudden my night flickered out on me. And there I was waking up. And I just had a few quick, almost still frames of my last memories of the night. And I went downstairs to find some friends to find out what had happened. And, like, I walked into this room, and the whole room went quiet. It was like an after school special, just a bad moment, you know. And one guy got up, and he walked me outside. He's like, I got to talk to you. And I just was like, oh, God, you know, what happened? I just didn't understand. I didn't know there was any such thing as a blackout. You know. And actually, that night, and again, I was only, like, maybe a week into college, you know. It was, like, in the first week, maybe, or third time ever drinking, and I had this blackout, and I had ended up blacking out with a man in the lounge of, like, a 300-person dorm in the middle of, like, a very, obviously, a completely sexual act. All these, kids had come through with their cameras, taking pictures, and they'd left the man down there covered in shaving cream, and one of the boys had actually picked me up and deposited me into bed. That boy ended up taking alcohol classes, being sentenced to alcohol education, and I remember back then thinking, God, lucky I got out from that, you know. I mean, it's just funny, because let me tell you, that was the beginning of 5 years of blacking out every time I drink. And I really mean that. I don't know what it is about, like, my physical constitution, but every time I drank from that point out, I blacked out. So and because it was so magical and because it did so much for me, from the very beginning, I was drinking about 6 days a week. And then by the end of my 5 years, I was drinking every day. And that's all I can say about it. You know, we all have our drinking stories, but, I mean, honestly, when I got alcohol in me, it was just, I could not stop drinking. And I actually did try to stop more than once. And every time I couldn't do it, I had to get back to it. And the only way I could stay stopped for any period of time was to, you know, make sure I was not sober in other ways, you know. And but I actually did try to stop drinking just a few weeks after that first blackout, because already in college, my first year of drinking, 3 weeks into my drinking, my best friends, this one girl in particular was developing into my best friend at college. And it was like week three of college, and she pulled me aside, and she broke up with me, essentially, you know, saying, I don't know what's happening to you, but I can't do this. I can't be in this relationship. You are really turning into such a drinker. I don't know what to do with you. And she broke up with me. And I wanted to prove to her and to others, my roommate in particular was this lovely girl named Lori, who was like totally normal, just like came out of the womb, a nice girl. Everyone who I was developing friendships with there were pulling away and saying, we're really concerned. So like 3 weeks in, 3 weeks into my drinking, I tried to stop to prove everybody wrong. And I said, I'm going to stop for a month, you know, and I couldn't even come close to it. I mean, it was a joke. It was like, well, I'm deciding to return to drinking again because I know on the inside I don't really have a problem. I just like to live life really hard. I like to suck the marrow out of life, I used to say, and other people don't, you know? And I had no idea I was like in the grips of a progressive spiritual fatal illness. I had no idea. I just knew that I loved to drink so much. I mean, I loved it. I mean, I like cherished it. That's how much it meant to me. Cherished it. Like, I love you. I love you. You know, I mean, like, and I loved it. And it was, you know, it really saved my life there for 5 years, honestly. But as I said, over the course of those 5 years, it also ground me down. And at the end of those 5 years, it was like, I always have this image, like, you know, when a dog ends up old and knows it's going to die, it, like, drags itself away from its family into the shrubbery. It's like, that is how I felt. Like, on some animal level, like, I absolutely knew in my stomach, in that place where, like, you know, you can't lie down in here. It's like, you know, I knew that I was dying and that I didn't have a whole lot of time left. But that's a really hard thing to know when you don't even know what your problem is. I mean, that's where I was at. You know, I knew I was dying like an animal knows, but I had no idea what my problem was. So, how did it come to pass? I knew that I wanted to kill myself and that it was growing, you know, and I wanted to start, you know, killing myself actually in high school too. I just started getting so dark and pickled and sarcastic and hopeless about the way I felt. But when I found that, you know, when I found alcohol, honestly, it was like a pause. I was like, oh, well, this helps. You know, and but over those 5 years, like my physical body and just like the obsession had taken such a toll on me that I did go back to a doctor. I thought, you know, I think I need to get back on some medicines again. I stopped taking medicines, you know, like, and I was like, I guess I need to go back to another psychiatrist and get back on some meds. So I went in there one day, you know, yellow as a corn husk and shaking and very angry. And it's like, all right, we got to get our talk on and you've got to give me some prescriptions. And she started asking me some questions about my drinking. And I was like, so angry, like, we're getting off topic here. Are you listening to me? I was like, I'm not doing well. Look at me. Not doing well. Don't have a lot of time here. I've got to get my medicines back. I'm telling you, I have a problem. It's depression. It runs in my family. And she did not want to listen to that at all. And I was so angry with her, but God bless her. That was like one of my first loving people God put in my life to nudge me to what would be the solution. She, like, I swear to you, I don't know how many minutes we were in there, but she didn't even want to hear anything else I had to say. she said, I really can't help you, and what you do need to do is go to rehab, and I'm going to make the appointment for 8 o'clock the next morning. She told me where it was. I was so upset with her. And I remember, I mean, I told her that. I was like, you know, not nicely, yelling, you're not hearing me, you're not listening, I'm telling you I have depression, I need some medicine, you're talking about my drinking. And what's so crazy is that it's kind of funny, our minds get so warped when we're drinking. Our perception, we can't determine the true from the false, it says. Yes, that was me. And I remember when she was asking me questions about my drinking, I actually minimized a great deal. Like, because, like, somewhere I just knew, like, she should not have the whole of the truth. And this woman was freaking out so badly about my greatly minimized answers. And for some reason, I twisted that to think that she was incompetent. And I was so angry. And I raced out of there. I stole some books, like, at her, like, ha-ha, and ran out and just left. And try to ignore the exchange altogether and go back to work the next day. And this is another thing that makes me sad. And it does make me sad because I trust that God has me on a path. And I trust that, you know, I'm just where I'm supposed to be. But I had this job, like I've done ballet my whole life, you know. And I actually got this job at like a ballet magazine, like the oldest ballet magazine. I loved it. And I lived with this woman who was like one of my closest friends. We had a little palm tree in our backyard. You know, it's like, I think about that, and I'm like, God, I messed up so much, you know, but I know today I had to mess it all up to figure out what my problem was to find the solution. But at that point, I tried to go back to work, and I just couldn't do it. And a few days later, the word that got me sober was tired. I knew nothing. I mean, this is almost like a new language, you know, if you're new, it's like, what? Resentment? What does that mean? You know what I mean? Like, what? And I decided I was so bone tired that I would go to rehab because I would get 2 weeks off work. And that's what I did. And I went to rehab. I was scared they wouldn't take me in, but they did. And I needed that 2 weeks off of work. I was just so very tired. Tired in that way, you know, like I said, like a dying dog. So I did go to rehab. And again, you know, that was a lot of people in white jackets with weird movies made in the 70s and charts and talks and circles, rate your feelings, how are you feeling today, 1 to 10. And I was like, it's horrible. I mean, because I was always saying like a 2 or a 3, and it never changed. And other people were like, oh, I'm like a 7 today, doing pretty good. And I'd be like, really? I'd be like, I'm in hell, you know, because the thing is, they wanted you to stop drinking. So I tried. I was so desperate feeling. I was like, all right, I'll give your non-drinking alcoholism a try. So I was like showing up every day not drinking, I mean, literally watching these weird movies, people in bell bottoms. And there was one movie where they had gotten an actual elephant. And there was this movie, and it was the elephant in the middle of the room. And there was this elephant, and we were in the dark, and I was just sweating. You know, you sweat in early sobriety, you're, like, just toxic. And I'm just in the dark with, like, weird people in the ghetto of San Francisco watching this movie like, I'm not going to make it. You know, like, there's no way. Can't do this. Where am I? You know, and it was no solution. There was no solution in that for me. And they did make us go to meetings, though. And I started going to AA meetings, but I went as I pleased, and I was still going back to my bars and my clubs at night, freaking out, you know. I'd go every night, and I'd freak out, and I'd take a cab home, and I'd watch a movie, and I'd cry. And I swear to you, this cycled for a long time. And I guess, I mean, I just got to tell you, like, when I stopped drinking, I went to meetings, so that's all I did, you know, and this is a spiritual program of action. Not drinking is, like, one of 100 things, basically, we have to do differently. And so I was doing that one thing and nothing else, and tempting alcohol to come back into my life again with going to those dangerous places. I mean, I was, like, leaning up on bars like this, ordering Sprite on the rocks, feeling that sticky alcohol on my arms, smelling it, and just like going insane, obviously. And And what happened to me is in that time is I tried that first time in rehab to stop drinking, and I went so insane that all of my previous insanity seemed really, really not so bad. And my desire to kill myself became my new obsession. It trumped everything else. It trumped, I couldn't think of anything else but wishing for the end. And that's what the big book says. It's like eventually, any alcoholic is going to come to the place where they can't imagine a life with alcohol, and they can't imagine a life without alcohol. They'll know loneliness as few do, and they will wish for the end. And that is where I was at, you know, with my first go at not drinking and having no spiritual program of action in place, just Susan, like, in her little flesh house on this earth with no alcohol and no solution. Like, the only thing I could do, the best I could do, was to pray to die and to do things like I would cross busy San Franciscan streets without looking either way, just hoping to be struck by a car. I didn't have the courage to do, to really take it into my own, you know, I didn't have the courage to totally carry it out, but I would do things like that to try to hope that it would just happen to me. And ultimately, I returned to work after rehab and again, trying still not to drink. I guess I had probably, it was like a two-week program or something. I probably had like 3 weeks. As it would turn out, I would hit my mark just before 3 weeks, and I'd always end up drinking again, you know. But the first time one of my first days back to work, I had to drive across the Bay Bridge to Oakland to get to my job. And one of the first few days back, I just felt like, I've seen a lot of people go back to drinking, and the thing I always notice is that before they go, that debate, you know, that struggle, it quiets. And it's like the disease or the illness, it's one. And it's just a quiet thing. And it's like, and that's how I felt, actually, that day. That day when I got up to get in my car, it's like I just felt in a very calm, quiet, non-dramatic way. I was like, I am going to drive off the bridge today. And it was like very, like, it wasn't like a big dramatic thing. It was like a fact that I knew. You know, I just knew that I was going to do that. And so instead of driving over that bridge into work, I drove back to the rehab. You know, I didn't know what to do. But the thing that really helped me was I really didn't want to do that to my mom and dad. I'd seen growing up this girl, a teenager, be killed in a drunk driving accident, and I saw the household fall apart. And I saw the parents stop going to church, and they got divorced and never left the house, and it was horrible. And I kept thinking about that, and I was like, I really want to try not to do that to them. And so I drove down to the rehab again, and I said, I'm going to kill myself. I told my counselor what I knew was going to happen if I drove to work that day. And that was the first time I went straight into the mental hospital that day, and they put me on suicide watch. And that was one of many times to cycle in and out of the mental hospital. And looking back now, I know what was going on so clearly. You know, I would try to stop drinking, and that was it. And the only thing that made me want to do was go so crazy I wanted to kill myself. And instead of killing myself because I didn't want to do that to my parents, I would drink again. And that was my cycle. And my parents were, like, at a total loss. And I also knew 100% that they didn't get it. Like, my dad, I remember he was so upset. Like, my dad and I are so close. Like, we've always been effortlessly so loving, you know, like, just blessed to have it like that, you know. And the first time he went to pick me up at the mental hospital, like, they got that call, and they were like, we have your daughter. She's on suicide watch. She's in the mental hospital, Langley Porter, out here. I mean, they were shocked. Shocked. They were like, what? I mean, they get a call from, they were just taken aback. And my dad flew out there, my parents both did, and my dad was like, got me up early the next day. He's like, come on, get dressed. He had to dress me, you know, and he's like, we're going to walk, we're going to go get a paper. And he's like, we're gonna get this figured out. And he took me down the street. He got a paper. He's like, we're gonna rent some bikes today. We're gonna get you some fresh air. He's like, you just have to look at it differently. You know, he's like, you just have to. He says, Susan. He said, thank God. He said, thank God. You know, you're not a paraplegic. Can you imagine if you're a paraplegic? And it's like, at the time, I was like almost angry at him. I was like, it was anger that was coming from fear. Because I knew that he didn't get what I had. And I was like, I'm going to die. Like, no one can even tell me what my problem is. And he loved me so much. And I knew that was his best way of trying to, like, be compassionate and uplifting. And I knew that that was not going to do anything. And just in the way all those doctors at the rehab hadn't touched me, you know, there was, like, no depth and weight to their message. There was no relating. And that's, you know, still today what saves my life is the identification of another alcoholic sharing their struggle and their hope and their strength and knowing that we relate in a way that only alcoholics can relate to each other, you know. And what happened was I couldn't stay at the mental hospital, and they actually moved me into a mental hospital. Back home. They flew me back home. I went to live there, like, address changed many months, and my parents were just thinking, if we can only get your medicines right, you know, we'll get you fixed up. And the one thing that had happened to me before I actually flew home was one random meeting. I did see a woman come up in an AA meeting, and I'll never forget her. She had a headband on and, like, a haircut, clean trim bangs, a skirt. She was, like, showered. She had bright eyes. And she was up there, and she was talking to the whole room, men and women. No, she wasn't much older than me. And the stories that she was saying about her drinking, she actually had one story, like the story I just told you about that, you know, demoralizing episode in that lounge with the photos taken. She almost had an identical story that involved a video camera. I was so shocked. I couldn't help but literally run up to this woman after the meeting. I'd heard of the word sponsor. That was a word I actually had heard in my, like, flighty ninja AA state of, like, just darting in and out of random meetings. I heard the word sponsor. And I had, like, determined long ago I was not going to get a sponsor. What? I don't need, like, a babysitter. I had no understanding of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I literally would, like, dart in and out. I'd be like, and I'm like, okay, done, you know, like, oh, why isn't it working? I want to kill myself, and not, you know. And, but I ran up to her, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and nothing came of it, because I didn't do anything about it. I mean, she did come over one day, we watched Xena, and I, like, told her some embarrassing drinking stories. But I never got that girl, and I never will, and, because that was the first time in my life I heard somebody say something that had some identifiable depth and weight, where I was like, whoa, like that inner little dying animal perked up for the first time in my whole life and had to talk to this woman. I had to talk to her. And when I shipped out to this mental hospital back here on this East Coast, the same thing happened. In our alcohol and drug class, I mean, this place was crazy. It was a straight mental hospital. I mean, I was in there with straight, crazy people, scared. Do you know what I'm saying? Living with them, hanging out with them all day long, and again, intuitively knowing, like, I didn't have that kind of problem. It was something different. But in this one alcohol class that we would go to every day, there was this man, Joe, and he, on my first day there, talked about waking up from a drinking episode, walking to the window to get his bearings, and seeing a cactus, and being like, oh, dear. You know, like, I did not start out this night in any place where cactuses grow. And I was like, oh, you know, like, oh, my God, I had that same feeling as when I heard that woman who was showered with a headband talk. I was like, oh, he gets it. I drank like that. Oh, my God, you know, that feeling of hope, just like, oh, You know, like, I'll never forget Joe, you know? And he just absolutely drove it home. He's like, you've got to hook up with other young people your age and sobriety. You've got to do this. Your life depends on it. And I eventually did, you know? I graduated to the day program, and when I did that, I was able to go to meetings around my area at night, and he kept hounding me to go to this one young people's group, and I did end up at that young people group, and that whatever I don't it's he would tell me about a specific meeting called choir. He said it's a lot of young people. The name of the meeting is choir. Go find it. I was like, hell no, I can't sing. Why are you setting me up for failure? You know what I mean? I remember that. It makes me think about that meeting, you know, because it's like, I was like, I'm not going to choir. My Mrs. Boggs in sixth grade would pull my parents aside and say, your girl's hopeless, you know. And I actually specifically did not go to that meeting for a very long time until I came to understand it was like just the name of the meeting. But I did end up at a meeting in the area where I live in Bethesda. There are, and again, it's not a coincidence. This is my loving God making sure I'm taken care of. There are all these young people who are sober in my area. And that's a rare, rare thing I've come to find out. And I ended up in a meeting with all these people my age. And they all just looked happy and clean to the point of being nerdy. I mean, that's where I was coming from, like, I'm like in the day program of a mental hospital looking down on these sober, happy people my age. Like, oh my God. Basically what happened was that desperation I talked to you about was my saving grace, because I was straight out of ideas, and I'm so grateful for my bottom for that. I investigated every which way possible to find out what was wrong with me and what to do about it. And I was out of options. And I went to this one meeting, which is now my home group. It's called Midtown. I stood at the top of the stairs. There was hundreds of people there. And I have, I'm blessed with this memory bubble. I remember looking down at the crowd, being obviously terrified to go in, but thinking, well, if this doesn't work, then I am going to kill myself. I'll have known I've tried everything, you know. And again, it was very quiet and very undramatic. And it worked, you know. And what happened was I got hooked up with a bunch of people who read this every day and do what the black part says. And my whole life changed, you know. The first thing that happened was I was harassed to the point of wanting to run and flee to the hills about having a sponsor. I mean, that was the first thing that happened, was an all-on assault. And I was like, you people are rude, you're pushy, I have a life. Thank you very much, a meeting every day. I have a life. And it's funny, because I really didn't. I was attending a day program of a mental hospital. I'd lost my job, I'd lost my apartment, I'd lost all my friends. I was living back with my parents again at the age of 23 in their attic. I was back on allowance. And I was like, I've got things to do. I mean, it was just like, what? And the fellowship, and you know, in A Vision for You, it talks so brightly about our fellowship, how we will finally find like a permanent release of our worries and our fears in this bright warm spot of our fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, I think, is what first kept me here and kept me interested. I gave into the peer pressure and I got a sponsor, and that's what saved my life. I mean, straight up. This woman hadn't even done her fifth step yet. She hadn't done her fourth step yet. She had only 4 months of sobriety. But to me, and I've like heard whispers of like, I remember one man in our group, this tall guy, Chris, had like something over 10 years. And I was like, what is his deal? You know, and I couldn't even fathom that. But this woman with only 4 months of sobriety was a goddess to me. I was like, 4 months. I was like, that's impossible. How? You know, this is my third sobriety date, you know, and she was a goddess to me, and I just said okay, and my whole sobriety has come from that. And let me tell you, I mean, she hustled her butt through the steps because I was ready to go. I was like, if this is a solution and I'm still here and something's working, I haven't killed myself and I haven't been cuddling with the butcher knife, lately, which I used to do. I would just, like, lovingly press it into my little tummy area right here. Like, God, how would that feel, like, in this longing way? That had not been happening for a while. And people were calling me, and I was hanging out. My first sponsor with 4 months hustled her butt through the steps because I was ready to go. So she scurried away and got that fourth and fifth step done because I was like, all right, let's go. You know what I mean? And it's just a beautiful thing to think about that, you know? And she actually ended up starting to go back to strip clubs. And I love strip clubs. Love them. And I knew. No one needed to tell me. I was like, that's a sinking ship right there, you know? And I knew that from my own experience, which, again, I'm so grateful for my bottom. That was my first little bit of conviction there. I was like, my sponsor's starting to go hang out at strip clubs. I'm doomed, you know? I was like, ah! And I got her sponsor. So basically what happened is I've been so blessed with my sponsors, and I've been, you know, at times hauled through the steps, and at times like, oh, the steps, you know? I mean, all different ways. And the 12 steps and the actions of the 12 steps have 100% saved my life. And my entire perception on life and purpose and what happiness means has been completely rewritten because of what's written in this book, you know? And I have some experiences today that are my own, that are, like, inarguable. They're, like, not up for debate. I don't care what you say. They're my experiences. You know, thank God for that. My whole life rests on them. And I'd like to think that that's what I get to transmit to the women I sponsor today. But one of the first things that happened was I resentfully resigned to trying 90-90, which is not in the big book, you know, but you know, it was suggested to me, and I was like, oh, fine, you know. And before I got to 90, I realized in the back of someone's car on the way to a meeting one night, I had stopped counting, you know. Like, oh, my God, what number am I at? I had no idea. And then the next thought was, and oh, my God, I hadn't thought about drinking. And I was a hysterical mess when I got here. Hysterical. Mentally ill. Certain I was mentally ill. I mean, from years back, I was a mess. And I realized this one night in the back of somebody's car on the way to a meeting that obsession to drink had been removed. Not by my doing. That is my first piece of proof here. Like, real, true, undeniable proof that a God is working in my life. I mean, that's impossible. The way I drank, with that obsession to drink, and how black and white of a change it made in me. I mean, that's an impossible thing. And that obsession was removed. And the thing is, I've seen it happen to everyone else who falls in with these steps. I've never seen it not work. Do you know what I'm saying? And even when I can tell you it's not working and it's painful and in my head, oh my God, I feel like I'm being ripped along a cheese grater, I'm still sober. It is working. You know, as dark as I can still get in my own mind, it is straight working. I am sober since 2000? What? That's crazy. That is not me. That's God working through me and me trying to follow these directions. That's what's going on there. And some of my other things that I'd really want to share about is the amends process. You know, steps 8 and 9. Those have completely filled out what my conception of God is. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, it's like, it's too magical to get into. I have like 5 minutes left here. I'm trying to, like, how do I condense it? It's been one of the most magical and meaningful things. It's totally changed my whole life and my whole way of thinking about God and what it means to, you know, be a human, honestly. This whole idea of me going to work, praying for clarity and sitting down with pen and paper and really giving it quiet attention and looking and examining and uprooting and fearlessly attacking my part has saved my life time and again here. I mean, I have gotten so resentful at times, you know, so justifiably angry, but every time I come back to the action of examining my part, I'm granted a change of perception. You know, and through my sponsor's help, I've gotten actions to take care of that. I've never had to you know, be a sinking ship over anything that bubbles up in this sick head of mine. The whole act of examining my part is so important. And obviously that's like the mainstay of step eight. And it was just pretty magical to go through that process, to examine my part and my part alone, drop that word blame and just look at how I was, the attitudes that caused that and the thinking there and looking at the actions and taking steps to go back and make those amends and find these people. The whole of it is so magical, and I found that God has made it like neon sign clear. Hey, Susan, it's time to reunite with this person because I'm going to plop this in your life like it's a movie. I mean, all I've had to do is do the pen and the paper and the praying, keep quoting my sponsor, and God has plopped me people through fantastic circumstances. I have been able to complete, you know, my eighth and ninth step. And what I mean by complete is I'm current. But it's never ending. You know, it's not a completion type thing. Because I'm always seeing more. The longer I stay sober, there's like layer after layer after layer. You know what I mean? I'm always seeing more and I'm always causing more damage. I'm always having to cycle back. To that action of examining my part, whether it's like in an eighth step type way or in a fourth step type way. And I am telling you that has saved my life. I have been so resentful. I've been so sick. I've been so selfish. I've gotten so far off the beam, living a double life. You know, I think about worship, and what that means to me is, how am I spending my time and my energy? You know, what am I allowing my head to entertain? What are my actions? You know, it's like kind of like living a spiritual way of life. It has to do with like quiet moments, you know, what's in my head, my prayer, my meditation, and then the actions of self-sacrifice that I take. And considering those two ends of the spectrum, I've gotten so sick and off the beam in both those areas that I've actually gone back into the hospital again. I mean, I've gotten really sick here, really resentful, and really off the beam here. And the book says we often find ourselves far off the beam. And I really believe that I'm deeply, deeply spiritually ill. And I don't believe it's ever going to be cured, but I believe 100% I don't ever have to drink about it again, and I don't have to self-destruct. Like either my life or all of the beautiful relationships in my life. Every time I've gone back and just followed this like an instruction manual, and I've never had to completely self-destruct. It's always lifted me up and out of whatever I'm walking through, no matter how bad it's gotten. This book and the instructions of the steps have always been strong enough to lift me up and out of it, always. And that's a conviction of mine today. And in my prayer life and in my meditation life, I've had some other amazing experiences that I can't explain, you know, but that have happened to me and through me that I know there's a God. And I know that whatever it is, I don't know what it is. I tend to think of it almost like as like just like a loving energy. I don't know, you know, but it's operating in my life all the time. And I don't know how it works. But I do know and I trust, and it's a conviction of mine, that if I follow these actions, it somehow enables me to be closer to that God. And it somehow enables everything. It just somehow greases the wheels all over, across the board, you know. I don't understand God, but I do my part to really spend good, quiet time with Him through prayer, through meditation. And then what I really need to concern myself here and here now on this earth as I'm living it in this life is helping God's kids, you know, and following these instructions and giving it away. And I think also the longer I stay sober, I love my sponsor, you know. I love her dearly. And my sponsor before that had for many years, I loved him dearly. And I love that he had me, he really lit a fire in my butt to seek, you know. He was a seeker, and I loved him for that. But even more so than that, and I think over the years, it's like I have got to stay sponsoring. So I can talk about myself all day long. But the act of really getting to the book for the girls I sponsor and shoveling it away and taking a care for somebody else, I mean, that's just utterly invaluable to me, you know? And it's a template for every relationship. How can I serve? No matter if I sponsor you, if I don't sponsor you, if it's at work, how can I serve? You know, and my old sponsor, Mike, used to say the highest position anyone can ever rise to is a trusted servant. It's like, oh, just a really nutshell for everything, it just seems like, you know? And so I'm really glad to be here, and I am so grateful to be sober. You know, I just owe, like, this is like this book, you know, in 12 steps, I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous today. Thank you.